It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. This year marks the 40th anniversary of the final withdrawal of U.S. troops from Vietnam.
The Viet Cong flag is flying over the presidential palace in Saigon today, just a few hours after the South Vietnamese government announced its unconditional surrender. The Provisionary Revolutionary Government gave Saigon a new name, Ho Chi Minh City. The PRG says it will follow a policy of peace and non-alignment in its foreign policy. And it says a general amnesty will soon be decreed. But it has said little else in the brief period since the surrender. We now have films of the emergency evacuation effort from Saigon.
It's part of a newscast on ABC from the end of April in 1975. On the anniversary of the final U.S. withdrawal from Vietnam, this hour we listen to the perspectives of four Iowa veterans of Vietnam, learn about the challenges they faced, how their involvement in the conflict changed them, and have our guests reflect on U.S. involvement in conflicts since Vietnam. Joining us in our Des Moines studio, Dan Gannon, Roger Elliott, Ron Langle, and Caesar Smith. Gentlemen, it's a pleasure and an honor to have you all in our studio today. Thank you for coming in.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
I want to invite our listeners today. No calls today during the show, as we usually do, but please do share your thoughts. We have plenty to listen to of experiences. That's why we're not taking calls today. But please do react with your thoughts and questions via our social media. Also, if you are a Vietnam veteran, we want to hear from you via email, if you like. Tell us about your experience in Vietnam, your reflections on that conflict. Our email, river2river at iowapublicradio.org. Or you can find Iowa Public Radio on Facebook, of course, or tweet us at IPR Talk. Dan Gannon, let me start with you. You are a former Marine Corps infantry commander in Vietnam, now Vietnam Veterans of America representative to the Iowa Commission of Veterans Affairs. Let's start with how it started for you. What were your motivations for signing up?
My motivations for signing up was I was going to get drafted. So I was getting ready to graduate from Iowa State University in 1968, and I was definitely going to get drafted, so I decided to, because of my college education, to try to make more of it, and then I decided to go to the officer candidate school at Quantico, Virginia.
Mm-hmm. You had have a brother who was in Vietnam before you were?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Did that play any role in deciding to go to Vietnam?
At the time, he was in Vietnam for about 4 months, and then he was severely wounded. Of course, if you got a brother that's severely wounded, the first thing you want to do is go get those guys. And so that did have some motivation in my first thought processes of joining the cause.
Mm-hmm. What are your starkest memories as an infantry commander in Vietnam? Give us a sense of what that was like in day-to-day.
Well, I spent my whole tour in combat as an infantry platoon leader, and I guess the darkest memories, I guess, are the most the times when one would be most fearful were nighttime, because at nighttime is when the enemy could move around, you couldn't see them usually, and it was always the worry of them ambushes or them overrunning your position.
Mm-hmm. And so what did you do at night to avoid that? What precautions did you take?
Well, at night you would set up a perimeter. You would dig in like you would do in any kind of a war. You would set up listening posts and various technology devices to help alert the approaching enemy. Plus, you would you stand watch. You were on watch 24/7, and there's a process you go through to do that with your troops to make sure you stay safe.
Mm-hmm. With all the danger you were in, how did you and your men cope with that?
I think maybe at first you're wondering how you're going to do that, and I think it's the thing it was a job. You did it every day, day in and day out, and you have to remember I was with my platoon. We were extremely close in combat, closer than I think that I would be with anyone else, family and so on, and you relied on each other. But it became a job, and we were well trained by the United States Marine Corps on how to do that, even though you were scared to death. But I guess it was the fact you had a job to do, and you were doing it as a team, and I guess that's what kept you going and kept you, I guess, in the right thought process of doing the job.
How many months were you did you serve as platoon leader in Vietnam?
12 months.
12 months. How many soldiers did you lose under your command?
That's a question that I would that people ask me. I have no clue because when I was in Vietnam, and as anyone who was in Vietnam, you were constantly having rotation of folks, whether they were going home, whether they were going in R&R, casualties of all types, and not just ordinary combat casualties, but sicknesses and illnesses. So you had a constant turnover of people. I lost half of my unit at least twice, but to actually come up with a number, I really couldn't tell you.
Well, that says enough right there to lose half your unit twice. What were the greatest challenges you faced, Dan Gannon, returning to civilian life in the United States?
I think the greatest challenges that I faced, the life, world had changed in 1 year. It drastically changed. And then when I came home, you had to cope with that, and you had to cope with the environment. One advantage I felt I had was I had 1 year left in the Marine Corps, so I think that helped to some degree. So when I got back to the States, I had one home for leave, and then I had another year left, and I spent that in California at 29 Palms. California is an officer position there, so that did help me somewhat, but coping was difficult after I got out of the service. Because things had changed, and I guess I had changed dramatically.
Mm-hmm. How so?
I think I had changed mentally because of all the issues and the stuff that I went through. I had post-traumatic stress issues, and anyone would go through that kind of a life experience where you're facing combat, where you're killing people, because that's not a human thing to do. When you come home, you're just a changed human being.
Mm-hmm. I want to talk with you more a little bit later, Dan, after we talk to the others about the challenge of facing PTSD. I know there's more of the story there. Let me talk with Roger Elliott. Roger, you were a master sergeant in Vietnam. When did you serve and for how long?
No, I was a master sergeant when I retired from the Iowa National Guard.
Okay, excuse me. Yeah.
And I was a specialist fifth class in Vietnam.
Okay.
That's what I got out of Vietnam as. Well, actually, I got out as a sergeant because I moved over to be a motor sergeant.
Mm-hmm.
My job, when I went over to Vietnam, well, first of all, I 1968 was a busy year for me. I joined the Army, graduated from high school, and went to Vietnam all in the same year. And that's what I wanted to do. That's where the action was. And
wait, is that why you wanted to enlist? 1968. There we're at the height in terms of troop involvement. Some 500,000 there, right?
Right. It is a reason. I wanted to go where the action was. You could say I was young and dumb, but that is a fact. But that's what I wanted to do, and I enjoyed my time in Vietnam. And like a lot of people, I was in an assault helicopter company. I was working on helicopters and actually living the dream, actually.
Mm-hmm. Not to say there weren't hazards, right?
There were hazards. Lots of hazards.
For instance?
Well, we got hit quite often. I was up in the central highlands of Vietnam, and when I went into the replacement center, they asked me where my orders were to, and I said, Bambi to it. And they said, oh, that's known as Rocket City, because they got rocketed a lot and mortared a lot up there.
Mm-hmm.
Because being an aviation unit, if they get rid of the helicopters in Vietnam, they pretty well stifle the war. And that's it was every third night you had to pull perimeter duty, and that was always something to look forward to. Most of the nights you would sit out there, and there wouldn't be anything happen, but you're still out on the perimeter, and you're looking into a dark jungle, and it's scary.
Mm-hmm.
And there are times that you did get hit. There are times when the bullets would whiz past your head and you go to full alert and you get shot at, you shoot back. Mm-hmm. I was up in a tower one night and rockets came in and mortars came in. Underneath the tower, the mortars were coming in, or the rockets were coming in underneath the tower. And there's a few exciting days. And actually, I was young and dumb at the time, and there's something about the adrenaline rush when something like that happens. Yes, it's scary. You're scared to death, but it's also invigorating.
It strikes me, you said living the dream, and you're obviously thinking about some parts of your service in Vietnam fondly. What is it that you would like to experience again, if I can put it that way?
Well, I did a lot of flying in helicopters.
You like that?
And I like flying in helicopters.
Okay.
It's fun. I never flew in a helicopter until I was in Iraq 9 years ago and flew in a Black Hawk. And what I tell my friends that I was deployed with, I was in the National Guard and I was deployed to Iraq. But what I tell my friends, they don't realize all those pictures they send back. I get a lot of pictures from them, and I'm saying you don't realize you're actually living the dream that all your friends wish they were doing.
Mm-hmm. Roger Elliott, we want to talk to you more about Iraq as well compared to Vietnam. You were one of our four veterans who actually was in Iraq as part of the National Guard a few years ago. We'll talk about that a little bit later. If you just joined us, we're marking the 40th anniversary of the final withdrawal of U.S. troops from Vietnam, getting the perspectives from four Iowans, four veterans of the Vietnam War, learning about their experiences, how it changed them, and other reflections this hour. Perhaps you are a Vietnam veteran. We're not taking any calls this hour, but we'd love to hear from you, perhaps for a future show. If you'd like to email us as a Vietnam veteran, please do so. Tell us a little bit about your experiences, your reflections on that conflict. Our email, rivertoriver@iowapublicradio.org. Our email, once again, rivertoriver@iowapublicradio.org. Ron Lengel is with us as well. Ron, you, I see in my notes, are the only one of the four who were drafted to serve in Vietnam. Tell us, what were your thoughts when your draft notice arrived, and what year was that?
I was drafted in July of 1969, mm-hmm. and I was not afraid to be drafted. In fact, I allowed myself to be so. I was in college. I wasn't quite sure what I was wanting to major in. I knew I was going to be a farmer. I couldn't see, spending 4 years in college to be a farmer. I grew up in admiration of the World War II veterans. Several of my uncles served in World War II, and I always thought that one day when my country needed me that I would step up and I would also wear the uniform. However, because of the political turmoil and the civil unrest of the 60s, I didn't know for sure, about this situation. I decided to just allow the draft to take me rather than to enlist.
Mm-hmm. Tell us about your work. You became a medic. Who did you treat? Under what conditions?
Well, I actually had three distinctive, different duties and occupations in Vietnam. Initially, I was assigned to a unit called MedCap. It was Medical Civil Action Program. It was a kind of a public service thing trying to show the Vietnamese that the Army wasn't all filled with people who shoot and fight, that we also had compassionate people and we treated civilians. I was on a specialized team. We were escorted in by convoy to villages and hamlets. On a kind of rotating basis, we would continually visit these certain villages and hamlets. It was always secured by the infantry before we went in and secured while we were there. And on places where they were a little bit in doubt about the safety, we had helicopter gunships circling above us. I was a corpsman. I followed the direction of the doctor. As Vietnamese came to us with their different ailments, the doctor would prescribe a certain treatment, and then that's what I would do.
Mm-hmm. So you treated Vietnamese. Did you always know that they were sympathetic to U.S. and South Vietnamese aims?
No.
So in some cases, you might have been treating the enemy?
After about 4 months, I went into the first sergeant and I said, "Sarge, I want out of this med cap team." And me being a private E3, I thought I might get in big trouble. But the first sergeant rolled back his chair, he crossed his arms, and he said, "Ron, you figured it out." I said, "What did I figure out?" He said, "You're in a highly dangerous all-volunteer activity. I couldn't get any volunteers, and I just stuck you in it." And I said, "Sarge, we're treating the enemy. There's some serious burns that come in, and I think they're powder burns. There's some holes that come in these people's bodies, and I think they're bullet holes. And my conscience says I just cannot treat the enemy." And so he said, "Well, all right, now I can't hold you in there. And when a new guy comes, I'll assign you into a different unit."
Mm-hmm. And you moved on to?
Well, at that time, our supply and transportation people were short of drivers for convoy. And me being a farm boy, they tried me out in all those different trucks, and I could handle them as well as those guys who went through the training. I hauled troops and supplies for about 4 months in convoy. I was all over the place. I know I was inside Cambodia when we hauled away munitions and supplies that we discovered along the Ho Chi Minh Trail. That was very interesting. But my darkest memories, the darkest images of Vietnam occurred during my second segment in Vietnam. No, I was also a truck driver, but when I'd be back in base camp, they would call me from the medical battalion, and I would have to assist a doctor and go to graves registration. And at graves registration, we would pull body bags out of the drawers of the coolers, refrigerators, or whatever like that, open the body bag, and we would have to try to identify the body. We would have to fill out the paperwork, you know, for notification of next of relatives, cause of death, different things like that. Mm. That part, those images and those smells are what stick with me and haunt me.
To this day.
To this day. There are times that I realized that because of our MIA situation, there were some of those body parts we could not recognize who they were. A lot of times a helicopter would be crashed. It would burn. The Vietnamese would then put a perimeter around it, and we couldn't retrieve the bodies for several days. The bodies would be in deterioration. Body parts would be deteriorated very badly. And there's no way of knowing. In the heat of battle, somebody could have just been tossed on a helicopter for evacuation and then it was shot down. So you didn't know. There was no billing arrangement or whatever, or a flight arrangement who was on any particular helicopter when it went down. And so some of our MIAs were probably in those body bags in pieces, but we just had no way of knowing who that was.
Certainly very important work.
Yes.
Nothing to envy there in your work. Were you able to talk about your work in grave registration when you came back? Did you keep that pent up? What did you do with that? How did you cope?
I came back from Vietnam, and I tried to block it out of my brain. I was engaged before I went there, and we were married right away. We had 4 children. I got my start at farming, and I just dedicated myself to all of that. At times, I would even catch myself, was I really in Vietnam? It was kind of a blank. You know, I had pretty much blocked it out. Then my children grew up, and they started to have children. My adult children said, "Dad, I know you're in the Army. I know you went to Vietnam, but what did you do?" I realized at that time that I had some problems, because I just could not talk about anything.
What would happen when you would think about talking or try talking about it?
Well, I would just shake. My lips would tremble. I'd cry. And I just couldn't function.
Mm-hmm. When did you finally come to talk about it? How?
Well, I went to the Veterans Administration. I talked to a counselor a couple of times. And
how long after the end of the war?
Probably 35 or 36 years.
You waited that long?
Oh, yeah. And then I started getting very active in veterans organizations, and I went on a couple fishing trips with Vietnam veterans, and we'd sit by the lake bank, and we would talk about our experiences and such. And the veterans organizations, I think, were the most helpful for me in talking to other Vietnam veterans.
Mm-hmm. Was there a moment that it just all came out and you were felt comfortable enough with the other Vietnam veterans to let it out?
It was only when I'd be surrounded by other Vietnam veterans. I wouldn't talk to anybody else. They didn't get it. You know, nobody else can really get it.
Mm-hmm. It did come out, and how did that help you?
Well, I felt like a big monkey came off of my shoulders, and I was then able to start to tell my children in bits and pieces, you know, what I had done, because they were asking, and I felt that I owed my children an answer. Today it's a little easier. It's a lot easier, in fact. But right now, as I speak to you, it is hard for me to remember that.
Mm-hmm. How often do you think of your experiences in Vietnam? Is it every day? Several times a day?
I think of it every day, but just a momentary thing. My biggest thing that I took back from Vietnam was just being grateful that I live. I am alive, and that I have all of my appendages, you know, and I'm able mm-hmm. to get up and walk away of my own accord.
We have to take a break in just a moment, but briefly, Ron, how did that experience change you?
It changed me from being a materialistic person into one that's more practical, I think. The little things in life are really the big things. You know, money, the big house, the big car, to me doesn't mean anything.
Mm. And what means something to you? What means most to you?
Being alive, being able to move about of my own accord, having friends, having family, having a sense of community.
Mm. Ron Langle is with us, a Vietnam veteran, one of four that we have in our Des Moines studio for this edition of River to River. From Iowa Public Radio News, I'm Ben Kiefer, and we want to certainly get, when we come back, get to know more about Cesar Smith, also a Vietnam veteran, and also have them reflect on the ways it changed them. Also reflect on the conflicts that the United States has been involved in since Vietnam. We're marking the 40th anniversary of the end of the war, at least the final withdrawal of U.S. troops from Vietnam. That happened in April of 1975. No calls today, but if you're a Vietnam veteran, we want to hear from you via email, if you'd like. Tell us a little bit about your experience in Vietnam, perhaps for a future show. Our email, rivertoriver@iowapublicradio.org. Back in just a few minutes. And we're back with more of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer, spending this hour looking back four decades. It's 1975 in April. That was when the final withdrawal of U.S. troops from Vietnam took place. And we're marking that occasion by talking to four Vietnam veterans from Iowa here. Cesar Smith is with us, Ron Langle, Roger Elliott, and Dan Gannon. We're getting their experiences, their reflections, four decades after the end, the U.S. involvement in Vietnam. Cesar Smith is with us as well. We learned about the other three in the first half hour. Let's learn a little bit more about you, Cesar Smith. You are unique in this group in that you were a career soldier and served in a couple of different periods in Vietnam. Tell us about your role.
Well, I was in Fort Riley, Kansas, when I got a call from the Pentagon to go to Korea. And they said, but you can volunteer to go to Vietnam. This was in 1964. And as a career soldier, I felt, well, it's probably best I go ahead and volunteer for Vietnam now as opposed to going to Korea. Of course, at that time, I didn't know that much about what was going on over there. And the first thing, they send us for 3 months of training, for insurgency training at Fort Bragg, North Carolina, and language school before we went to Vietnam.
Mm-hmm.
I got to Vietnam, landed in Tansanut, and the smells is the first thing I remember when I got off the plane. It was horrible smells over there, but I won't even go into all the things that were being burnt in the air, but if you had a kaibo and you didn't know what to do, what was in it, you burned it. And so that was part of the smell. But I got to got down downtown, and we spent 10 days in Saigon, which is a beautiful city. And remember, this is 64, so you couldn't even tell the war was going on in Saigon.
Right. And the U.S. involvement in 64, remind us, was in the tens of thousands at this point rather than the hundreds of thousands?
I believe when I got over there, there might have been close to between 11 and 20,000. They were starting to build up of advisors in 64. At that time, I don't know if the plan had been made to bring in American troops yet, but so there were more advisors coming in.
And your role at that time when you arrived?
Well, I was a second lieutenant, and I was going to be part of a four-person group, a captain, two sergeants, and a lieutenant as advisors to a Vietnamese infantry battalion. They put me on a plane out of Saigon, and when I think about it now how scary it was. I didn't think it was scary then, but we went to Tansanut Airport, got on a small army plane, just me and the pilot and my gear, and he flew me up to this place. Was probably about 50 miles north of Saigon, where the three Americans met me at the landing zone and went in town to our little hut, and that's where I joined and met the battalion that we were going to work with. And for the next 6 months, I worked as an advisor with that Vietnamese infantry battalion.
How successful do you feel you were in advising the South Vietnamese?
Oh, I don't think I was very successful at all. I think I was more successful at learning from the battalion commander how to stay alive and survive. The battalion we were with, the battalion commander had been in, I don't know how old he was at the time, but he fought in World War II against the Japanese. He fought against the French, and now he was fighting against the North Vietnamese. And at times, I'm not even sure he was really interested in the battle. I'm not sure he had his heart in the fight, but I learned a lot from him as to how to survive out there in the jungle. I mean, most of our advice was, we can bring in gunships for support and artillery for support. So we were kind of morally there to give them the kind of combat support they needed, more than just advising him on how to deploy his battalion.
This is quite a bit of time before the U.S. seriously ramped up involvement in Vietnam. But did you have a sense on the ground at that time that things were not going well?
Oh, yeah, I definitely felt that we were at the bad end of the deal. And at that time, we would sit around and say, if we'd bring in the American troops, we'd get this thing over with in a couple of years. I mean, we felt that that's all that was needed at the time, was to bring in the American troops. Of course, we didn't know what the big situation was, but at least it felt like working with the Vietnamese infantry battalions, there was kind of a stalemate war. I didn't see a lot of victories going on. As a matter of fact, I saw a lot more defeats and Americans getting killed and captured than I did big victories.
Your second time back to Vietnam, to fast forward a bit here, was in the late 60s, 68 and 69. I understand you returned. Now, we have when there was a much larger U.S. involvement, hundreds of thousands of troops in there. This is, I think, after the Tet Offensive by the North Vietnamese and the Viet Cong. You came back and did what?
Yes, I went back in August of 68. I joined the 3rd Brigade of the 82nd Airborne Division in Hue. President Johnson had started sending in more troops, and the 3rd Brigade of the 82nd Airborne was there when I arrived, and I was going to be a company commander with the 2nd Battalion, 505th Airborne Infantry. What I found out, though, after they told me I was going to be a company commander, they said it's a new company. And I didn't know what exactly he meant by a new company, but the battalion commander felt he needed an additional rifle company. So he said, I asked the other company commanders to give up some of their good men, and then along with the replacements, you'll have a new company. And I know I looked at him as if, what company commander would give up anybody good to go join another company in combat? But I couldn't say anything. I just said, yes, sir. And I joined a unit when I joined them, they weren't feeling too good about themselves. They'd come over together, they'd train together, and now all of a sudden, a lot of them pulled out of their units to make up a new company along with some replacements that came in.
So, what were your missions like? How successful were you?
Well, we became very fortunately very successful. We had 10 days together before we went on our first mission. And basically, when I first met with them, knowing they were airborne soldiers, I asked them what their mission was, and they gave me the good airborne salute and shout and rah-rah, they were ready to fight. And then I asked them what their other mission was, and they kind of looked at me like what I call the Cocker Spaniel look, cocking their head to one side, like, what was I talking about? And I said, our other mission is to make sure we work together to get everybody back home. And I think that struck with them, realizing that even though we didn't know each other, we did have to work well together. Mm-hmm. On our first mission out, they deployed the entire battalion, and it wasn't a good start. The helicopters dropped us off in the middle of a low area, and quite large, because they had to get in the helicopters. But it was quite a distance from the tree line, and it was about 110 degrees. And you got all this gear on, and these kids, this is the first combat mission. They were running like crazy to try to get to the tree line before they get shot. And they started falling right out there in the middle of the landing zone. And basically from, I think, fear and the heat and all that gear, some of them just passed out. Fortunately, nobody got hit, and we got into the tree line okay. But that was the start. The end of the mission, we ended up fine. We found the target we were supposed to get to. We found cache of weapons and came back, and they were feeling good about themselves.
Cesar Smith is with us, one of four Vietnam veterans we have in our Des Moines studio, as we remember the final withdrawal of U.S. troops from Vietnam. That is what we're marking here. Of course, they're telling their experiences from several periods during the Vietnam War. Up to then, the United States' longest and most wrenching war. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. So many stories that Roger, Dan, Ron, and Cesar, you all have here. We could spend many hours talking about them and find a lot of interesting experiences. But we only have about 15 minutes left here. I want to talk a little bit or ask you a little bit about the parts of the Vietnam War that experience that you had that still follow you today or followed you for years after you returned. Dan Gannon, I know one of the challenges you faced returning to civilian life was what we now call PTSD. It wasn't called that at that time, or was it?
At the time, I guess we didn't even talk about those things, and I don't think the post-traumatic stress disorder, what they call it today, and they're looking at trying to change that description. I don't think that came along until the 1980s.
What were your symptoms? Where were you in the deepest in terms of your stress afterwards in the U.S.?
Well, I think when I came home, it was the flashbacks and the nightmares of combat. And it's hard for me to talk about the specific firefights. That's the hardest thing, and I don't normally talk about that. But you have flashbacks and nightmares of those things. I do at night, which is it's the toughest time for me. And it's just flashbacks of a firefight or of a soldier getting killed or medevacs. You'd have flashbacks about getting overrun, because that was the most fearful thing that would happen at night, if it would happen.
Do those flashbacks happen to today?
Yes, they do.
Mm-hmm.
Go ahead.
Yeah. Do you feel like you're actually back there when that happens?
I do, but it's you know, it's in the middle of the night, and it just those things just come and go. And when I have one, yes, I'll wake up. I'm all soaked with sweat and shaking, and I get up and try to de-stress myself to some degree. But it's one of those things at the time. You feel like you're back there.
Mm-hmm. When the stress, when has the stress affected you most health-wise? Did you ever worry about your sanity, about if you could go on?
Yes, there were times that I had difficult with that, with the stress, and then other things refire those images and those thoughts, and they really have nothing to do with your experience in Vietnam. For example, I got diagnosed with cancer from Agent Orange, and when that happened, it refired a lot of, because I was under a stressful situation of the cancer, it refired those thoughts quite severe.
Mm-hmm. Caesar Smith, did you struggle at all with post-traumatic stress syndrome, as we call it today?
I did, and didn't really. When I first got back, it might have been 10 years or so before I had the first episode. Mine didn't only happen at night. It happened one time. My wife and I were in the car and stopped at a stoplight, and for some reason I had a terrible flashback. We were on a cruise and got off on an island where you could just walk around, and I had a flashback there.
What exactly happened during that flashback?
Well, the one on the cruise when I got off on the island.
It's okay if you can't talk about it. We'll come back to you. Thank you, Caesar, for trying. Roger Elliott, I wanted to get back to you because you are unique in this group of veterans that returned to combat in a later war in the U.S. You fought in Iraq as well as part of the National Guard. How did that experience compare with the combat you experienced in Vietnam?
Well, I was much older and hopefully much wiser. In Vietnam, it was all about the excitement. It was all about the action. When we got hit in Vietnam, it was an event. I mean, the gunships went up, the rockets went off, and it was a beautiful sight. I mean, we knew they were getting their butts kicked because our gunships could do that. And in Iraq, it was we did get hit, but when the gunships went out, they went out so far out that you couldn't see any of the action or anything.
You were more removed from the combat then?
Yes. Of course, like I say, I was much older too, and I didn't volunteer for some of the things I probably would have if I was younger. Some of the guys did go out, you know, and do some interesting things.
Let me ask you, if anyone has a specific, we hear in connection with Vietnam the homecoming that the Iraq and Afghanistan veterans get, and rightfully so, that they are welcomed back in a much better fashion than many of the Vietnam veterans were. I wonder if one or two of you could share a telling homecoming story that contrasts with the homecomings that veterans of recent times have gotten.
Well, let me just say my experience. When we came back from Vietnam, we came back singly, alone, and we weren't in a big group. Like when I came back from Iraq, we were in our company, and we had a big celebration when we got home. But when I came back from Vietnam, it was just, you get on the plane and you go home.
Mm-hmm. And you came and arrived where? In California somewhere? And
I arrived in Seattle, Washington.
Mm-hmm. And that was it? What, you turn in your kit and went home?
We had to leave. I went over to Germany after that. But
okay.
I had a 30-day leave, and we got on the plane at 7 o'clock in the morning, and the waitress or the stewardess came down and says, "Would you like breakfast?" And I said, "I'll take a bloody or I'll take a screwdriver." And she thought that was a little strange, but there's another guy sitting next to me that said the same. And of course, all the civilians on the plane sort of thought we were crazy. But I'd seen later there was all kinds of drinks going back to the back of the plane, and I looked back there and there was all the troops back there going back to their separate homes, you know.
Right. Ron Langle, what was your homecoming like?
Well, fortunately, I went through Oakland, California, and Oakland was kind of a hotbed for the protesters. But I came through it about 2 or 3 in the morning, and the protesters weren't that hardcore. They went to sleep at that time.
Right.
So it was uneventful for me at Oakland. I've heard many Vietnam veterans coming through Oakland were spit at, jeered at, objects thrown at them. It was terrible for them. And then when I got back home and I got about my life again in Templeton, Iowa, and on the farm, people didn't even know you were gone. You know, they didn't even realize you were gone for a year. didn't know you were in the Army even. And
just what wasn't acknowledged to a certain
nothing, extent. You know. It's like there were some things that came out, some different new inventions and things, and I'd say, well, what's this? They say, well, where have you been, under a rock? And I said, no, I happened to be in Vietnam. Well, you were? You know, so I like what's going on today. We were kind of punished, as soldiers. We were sort of punished by the public because they didn't like the political machinery, the politics of the time. But today, they may disagree with the public decision to send troops away, but at least our U.S. citizens don't take it out on the man or the woman wearing the uniform. And so we have grown up, I think, as a nation, and I really like that.
Cesar Smith, your homecoming, what was memorable about that?
The fact that no one was around when I arrived. I flew into San Francisco, and I think it was early in the morning. It wasn't quite that early. It must have been 9 o'clock or so when our plane landed in San Francisco. I was in uniform. And I was kind of ignored more than anything else. My forward observer, who I talked to years later, said when he arrived, he got spit on and cussed out. None of these that didn't happen to me. I always wore my uniform, but most of the time I was just ignored.
Hmm. And so, what you see today is also something that.
I think what they're doing now is wonderful. It's painful knowing that. So many of us came back, and so many, even those that were wounded, came back and still were treated poorly. Mm-hmm. I don't understand why that took place, but I'm very pleased with what they're doing for the veterans now.
Did the poor treatment at that time probably not help, at least perhaps hurt, in coming to terms with what had happened, what the experiences over there, make it even harder?
Well, I'm not sure that I felt that way. I felt bad that there was just no one caring one way or the other than getting out of the war.
Yeah.
As a career soldier, I think my feelings and focus were a little different than those that weren't. Yeah. And so we got by. We just kind of – it's kind of like the situations you were in Vietnam. You put it in the back of your head and keep going and don't think about it.
We have just over a minute left. Dan Gannon, we started with you. I want to ask you maybe some thoughts about your homecoming from Vietnam or some thoughts that you think you would like to leave with us as we finish up this hour, remembering the Vietnam experience.
My homecoming was similar to Caesar's and I think Ron's. It was at night. I can't even tell you where we flew into, but it was about 2 or 3 in the morning. You stayed with the unit, so I didn't really – have any negative things happen, I think, because it was so early in the morning. I think those issues came up later in dealing with folks about us serving.
Mm-hmm.
But one thing I want to leave, if anything I can leave, is
sure.
We all fought very honorably. We won our war, and I think that what irritates a lot of Vietnam vets today is, as you hear the thing, we lost the war. Well, the soldiers didn't lose a war, and I don't think there's a combat in a situation in Vietnam where we truly lost anything. So we won our war. It's just the politicians and their decisions caused the loss. So we get very offended when someone says we lost the war and we did not do that.
In a few seconds, we have literally 30 seconds left. So for Dan Gannon, the lesson of Vietnam is what?
I think the main thing is. We need to look at what we do as a country and not get ourselves into these situations. And remember, we're just one part of the world, and I don't think the U.S. soldier, the infantry soldier, needs to be doing all the fighting today when we have countries that can do the same thing.
Okay. I want to thank you all really genuinely, deeply, for coming into our studio and talking about some very painful things, opening up so that others can understand better the Vietnam experience. Our four veterans of Vietnam as we mark the 40th anniversary of the final withdrawal of U.S. troops. Dan Gannon, Roger Elliott, Ron Lengel, and Cesar Smith, thank you so much for coming in and for serving our country.
Thank you.
River to River is produced by Emily Woodbury, Claire Roth, and Lindsay Moon. John Pemble helped us out in Des Moines. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. We always welcome your comments and questions about this program. Contact us anytime. River to River@iowapublicradio.org. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.